Support for WGTD's morning show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenoshans who devoted much of their lives to the community and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and occasional morning show co-host. And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD HD. I'm Gregory Berg. Many of you have heard on the morning show from time to time my conversations with Jennifer Sassaman, who is on the theater faculty at the University of Wisconsin Parkside, and we've had many fun conversations about the interesting things being done at Parkside. You're going to be hearing from another Sassaman today in part one of today's program, Ginny Sassaman, who is Jennifer's mother. And Ginny Sassaman makes her home in the beautiful state of Vermont and is the co-founder of an organization called Gross National Happiness USA, and also created something called the Happiness Paradigm. And you can visit this really gorgeous website and find all kinds of information there and intriguing thoughts on happiness, something that all of us deserve to experience in our lives. And she does all kinds of activities related to this important topic, and also does workshops that spring out of her own background, certified in the field of positive psychology and her work in mediation and facilitation. She's going to be doing a workshop, actually, this Saturday morning at Olympia Brown Universalist Unitarian Church in downtown Racine, Saturday morning between 9 and 11, called Self-Care Tools for Stressful Times. And it sounds like an absolutely timely event for just about anyone who feels like the times in which we're living are especially tumultuous and sort of wonder what they can do to, in a sense, take care of themselves emotionally and mentally. And so we have a lot to talk about for these next few minutes. And Ginny Sassaman, all the way from Vermont, we welcome you to the morning show.
Good morning. I'm very happy to be here.
Glad to have you here. I've had the pleasure of speaking to your daughter on many occasions, and that makes this even more interesting and fun. So I'm glad you can be here. So first of all, tell us what the field of positive psychology is. You have a certificate in that.
And yes, I do.
What does that term refer to?
So positive psychology is a relatively new branch of psychology. For the way that most of us have thought of psychology through the years is that, you know, we go to see a psychologist, psychiatrist, social worker, whomever, because we're struggling in some way. From, you know, low grade, feeling blue, feeling like life just isn't what you want it to be, to, you know, much more serious illnesses that people may have. So speaking in kind of simplistically and generally, regular psychology takes us from ill or broken or not our best to normal.
Right.
And the idea of positive psychology is, how can we go from kind of normal, and with quotes around it, of course, because whatever is normal, but how do we go from normal to being our very best? How do we thrive? How do we flourish? How do we both experience the greatest joy in our own lives and also at the same time be at our best for other people and for the rest of the world? And it actually, this branch of psychology started in the 1990s. The person who's regarded as the father of positive psychology, his name is Martin Seligman, and he conveniently was head of the American Psychological Association when he had this huge aha moment that we could be using tools and knowledge and doing much more research to move people ahead in a much more flourishing way. Supposedly this happened because his 5-year-old daughter called him a grump. And he decided to do something about that. So since that time, there has been a lot of research on what truly helps us keep those happiness muscles strong, because it is kind of like a muscle. We need to keep working at it.
Right. And I can see how, I mean, somebody who is in the field of mainstream psychology might sort of take umbrage at it being the field being characterized as mostly there to repair ills. But you're absolutely right that that is sort of, in fact, what it has become. Because that is how the vast majority of people view it. And probably even most of its practitioners begin to, in a sense, view it that way, just because that's sort of the sweep of life in terms of who walks through the door. And there is a sense of urgency, of course, about those situations.
Right.
And
often quite urgent.
Right. And so this is a way, in a sense, to disconnect from that and think about psychology as something even beyond that in a really positive way.
Right, right. It's a fuller picture.
Yeah.
It's a fuller picture. And of course, I mean no umbrage to therapists, many of whom literally, seriously, are my best friends. And people, and of course, many psychologists who may specialize in certain areas. You know, one of my friends treats primarily children who've been sexually abused. Really, really, really hard work. But they're also embracing the tools that positive psychology has to share with. So how can we move not just to kind of healthy and functioning well, but functioning at our best?
Absolutely. So at what point did happiness become such a central theme in your own life and in your own work?
Well, I like to believe that I was fated to become a happiness expert because there's a family story about me that when I was maybe 18 months old and I was in my crib, the youngest in the family at the time, my mother says she heard me making noises and said, oh, I need to go see what the baby needs, and came in the room, and I was rocking back and forth saying, happy, happy, happy. So that, I think that's where it started, but then it was on a back burner for quite a few years.
Right.
It re-emerged. I actually got a master's in mediation. I was in my 50s, went back to school for that, and my master's thesis was about mediation and suffering. So I wrote and researched and wrote and researched all about suffering. And then after that, I picked up a book on happiness. And then I just picked up another book on happiness. And really, from then on, it was off to the races. For me, the way in really was not through the door of personal happiness. That came later. For me, the most transformative moment in my life of moving in this direction came from a book written by a fellow public radio person, Eric Weiner, who was a foreign affairs correspondent at NPR for many years. He also got pretty burnt out on the suffering he saw, so he decided to research the happiest countries. And there is data. There's lots and lots of data on where countries rank. In fact, a new report just came out Monday the 20th, the World Happiness Report. Anyway, he wrote a book called The Geography of Bliss, and he traveled to different countries to try to determine if there was a commonality among happy countries. And one of the countries was Bhutan. And I read the chapter on Bhutan. It was the first time I had ever read the words gross national happiness. And I was immediately taken with that and just said, wow, this is an amazing concept. And what happened in Bhutan? So Bhutan was a monarchy. It isn't now, but it was. And it was an isolated country for many, many years. And then as it was emerging to become more part of the world community, a poor country financially, a reporter asked the king, so what's the GDP of this country? And the king said, I don't care about that so much as I care about the gross national happiness of my people. And honestly, wow, it was like bells and whistles. Absolutely. Why aren't we all doing that? I mean, isn't that really what the role of government should be, to focus on our overall well-being? So the GDP, the gross national product, gross domestic product, is really, it has its place, but it's focused only on one aspect of our lives. And it's just focused on the exchange of money and goods and services. It's not focused on, do we have a beautiful park that we can go and take a walk in when we're sad? Do we have time to do volunteer activities at our church? It doesn't count grandmothers coming and taking time to babysit their grandchildren or grandfathers. I mean, there's so much of our quality of life, all of us, that is not counted when you constantly hear the GDP is this and the GDP is that. There's also a great quote from Robert F. Kennedy, a speech that he gave in 1968, which people can find on YouTube. It's his actual voice. So it's very moving. It's very compelling. And he talks about how GDP measures everything except that which matters most.
Wow.
It's beautiful. So I became very involved in starting a gross national happiness organization. I think the first one of its kind in the country. We had the first ever gross national happiness conference in the United States, and that was in 2010. And through that, then I learned about the science of personal happiness, which was also incredibly exciting. And now I work on both because I think they feed each other. So the more we're at our best, thriving, our happiest selves, the better able we are to see the big picture, positive, hopeful solutions that we can aim for instead of staying mired in the negative and the critical. So we are able to see the options for a more positive and hopeful future. And we have, when you cultivate your happiness, you have greater capacity to do the work that's needed. Greater resilience, greater creativity and problem solving. And at the same time, so personal happiness is important to changing the big picture, but the big picture is also incredibly important because it weighs down on all of us. And no matter what wonderful things are happening or not happening in our own lives, we're still all members of these bigger systems and societies, and we feel the weight of poor decisions. And you know, I'm sure everybody listening can think of sometimes over the last few months when they've felt like it's hard to be personally happy because the outside world is, as you said, pretty tumultuous right now.
You know, as you were painting this picture, you were it dawned on me too that one of the questions that has often come up is the matter of if one feels unhappy yourself or feeling somehow deprived, like you aren't getting your fair share or the world's left me behind or whatever it might be, and that might be true to some extent.
Absolutely.
That you almost certainly have a very limited capacity to worry about and or want to work for the happiness of others. You have this sort of sense that what about me, and sort of staking your own claim to happiness that you feel is owed to you or that you deserve to experience. And in a sense, there's no room for the bigger picture. And I think what you're suggesting is that one of the blessings of you yourself being happy and grateful and whatever you mean by the word happy, that also, in a sense, makes you interested in and available for and able to work for the happiness for everybody around you as well.
Yes, there's so much in what you just said. And I do, first of all, want to acknowledge, I know there are a lot of people in great pain. There have been members of my own family who have said to me they don't think they can ever be happy. I don't believe that's true. I believe everybody does have that capacity. Even in some pretty terrible circumstances, people can still find the ability to be happy, but it isn't easy. You know, if you're worried about feeding your children, that is, it's hard to be happy. But even people like Christopher Reeve, who became a quadriplegic, is able to be happy. Not right away, you know, not right away.
Well, and probably not every moment of every day.
Okay, so nobody is happy every moment of every day. And I'm glad you brought that up, because I like to bring that up immediately. I have had my share of crying and troubles. We all do. We all do. We all do. And one way to think about this is there's something called the positivity ratio. So this is a new science, happiness. The numbers are in dispute. But basically, we all want to aim for a ratio of roughly 3 positive actions, activities, interactions, whatever, 3 positives for every 1 negative in our lives in a day. So that's a lot of negative right there. I mean, it's a given. It's a given. It is part of life. And the happiness movement is never, never about not feeling sad. In fact, I think that the happier we are, the more free we are to feel sad too, because we know it's okay. We know it won't continue. Also, the more we allow ourselves to feel sad, the easier it is to also feel happy.
Hmm. So when you're using the word happy or happiness, are you using that term the way most of us use it most of the time? And I ask that because sometimes when people write about this or talk about this or discuss it, they don't really mean happiness in the sort of most normal sense of the word. I have a sense that you really do mean it. I mean, fairly close to what we, what most of us think of as happy. But really clarify what you do mean when you use the term.
Also an excellent question, the kind of thing that comes up pretty frequently. I think I do mean it fairly normally. I'm not that kind of esoteric thinker. So the way that I define happiness is a number of words. So I think of it as thriving, flourishing. I think of it as greater peace within, a greater sense of contentment, and also an enhanced capacity to feel positive emotions. So, you know, it's just easier to see that the glass is both half full and half empty, but focus on the half full part. And enjoy what's in it. And, you know, so it's pretty normal. It's pretty normal. And so that's personal. In terms of gross national happiness, people often use the term well-being. And so well-being and happiness are interchangeable. And that is used in terms of what kind of government policies, or it could be workplace, it could be any kind of community. What kind of policies can be enacted to best provide the conditions for people's overall well-being? So, you know, how do we protect the environment? How do we nurture relationships? One of the biggest problems in this country, and I don't hear it talked about very much on any kind of policy level, but one of the biggest problems is loneliness. Which causes health problems, et cetera. So how can the government actually create conditions that maybe help people connect better?
Let's talk about a couple of slightly more difficult matters. One of them being, to what extent is it possible to generalize about what makes people happy? Given that, at least at a glance, it often seems like what makes me happy is not what makes this person over here happy. I mean, that's, of course, part of what makes us unique and interesting human beings right, is that right. We don't all like opera, or we don't all like race car driving, or we don't all like skydiving or whatever. We are all different. So does this get complicated when it comes to, I suppose, particularly on maybe that national level in terms of if what makes you happy is a walk through the park and what makes you happy is playing video games all day. Does this get complicated when we think about it in those terms, and how do we wrestle with that complexity?
So I don't think it's complicated to think about it. I think actually putting policies into effect will get complicated. In terms of personal happiness, I like to think of it as being both universal and unique. So yes, we are all different, and at the same time, there has been a lot of research in, really well-known institutions, coast to coast in this country and around the world, to show that there are certain fundamentals. And in fact, the Surgeon General of the United States, I don't know if he's still the Surgeon General, but a fellow named Vivek Murthy, in December of 2016, he issued a paper saying that happiness is just as important to our health as diet, as stopping smoking, all the things that we think of as being fundamental. He said, so is happiness. And he broke that down into a couple of key areas that seem to really apply to everybody. One of them you already mentioned, which is gratitude. Gratitude. I've heard the teachers who've taught me happiness who have said they don't know of any really happy person who doesn't have some kind of a gratitude practice. So gratitude is pretty important. Pretty important. Also, relationships. We all need them. And again, there was a study done on the happiest people and what traits did they share in common. And the one aspect that it seems is really necessary to happiness is relationships. But there's a good example of how we're different. So some people, like my daughter, who you've had here, my daughter is so extroverted. She has so many friends and so many relationships, and that's what serves her. My son is much more introverted, and he doesn't need to have that many people in his life. So you don't have to have, scores of best friends. You can have a couple. But we all need some meaningful relationships.
Connection to somebody.
Connections to somebody. And so the workshop that I'm going to offer on Saturday morning, and really most of the workshops I offer people a variety of science-tested tools and strategies. And I don't expect anybody in the room, myself included, to do them all. I mean, we couldn't. You wouldn't do anything else in your day except work on being happy, and that would not be happy. So there are tools and strategies that work for each one of us but don't necessarily work for everybody.
The other question I really wanted to ask you along this line is that I think when we look at, for instance, the people in our lives or the people that we know, even fairly casually, I think maybe this is especially true of that. I mean, people we see at work or who cross our paths in a fairly peripheral way, but maybe fairly regularly, that it's really easy to think about some people just in general being happier than others, but in a way in which it seems like certain people are just, they seem to be predisposed to being happy, like as though they emerged from the womb a little bit happier than, well, you kind of told a story about yourself sort of along those lines, but just sort of wired to be happy versus others that for whatever reason just do not seem to have that same predilection for whatever reason. And of course, we're also talking about a world in which more and more people seem to be contending with things like depression and so on. how significant a reality is that, what I just described in terms of people's sort of general makeup before they ever even consciously think about being happy or not? And does that make a difference in terms of how this should be approached?
I just love your questions. They're so complex and layered.
Oh, great.
I want to say one thing first, the depression piece. Yes, depression is at a peak. The suicide rate in the United States hit an all-time high last summer, a report
really?
Came out. We're not, I mean, if we, again, if we look at the GDP is going up, but our happiness is not going up. This might seem to some people like a light and fluffy and fun topic, you know, and it is fun. I am totally serious about this movement because
right.
we need it. And we need it badly for ourselves and our loved ones and the world around us. So there's that. Yes, mm-hmm. depression is up. And yes, people are born. Some people come out of the womb happier than others. The estimate is that how happy we are or are not is determined by our genes, but only about 50%. So 50%, yeah, we're born that way or born another way. And I always think of Michael J. Fox. He's like, man, he must have been born happy. He just seems so happy.
Despite what he's contending with.
Exactly. Our happiness is not dependent on the trials and tribulations that we face. So, again, new field of study, numbers are fungible, but the belief is that if we have enough food to eat, if we're not in a war zone, then our external circumstances account for about 10% of our happiness. So, you know, do I have a job that I like? Do I feel like I'm in a safe house? Whatever those circumstances are. But about 40% of our happiness is internal work that we do ourselves. It's taking the time for a gratitude practice. It's taking the time to cultivate optimism, which is not a birth trait. People think they were born optimistic or pessimistic. That is not true. So you can cultivate your optimism. You can cultivate your kindness and your generosity and your resilience. All of that can be cultivated. And I have not seen anything in the research that says tools work better or worse depending on how you were born. The tools just work.
And maybe some people need to use them more. is that fair to say?
I hadn't thought of it quite like that ever. That's kind of interesting.
That's maybe a simplistic way to look at it.
But maybe not. Maybe not. Some people probably have to hang in there a little bit longer before they start feeling the effects. But like Martin Seligman, for example, again, he's the grumpy father of positive psychology. He worked with a lot of depressed people, and he used some of these very simple, basic tools with people who were clinically depressed, not just feeling blue, and they showed a distinct improvement over a period of about 3 months till the tools kicked in. So they can work for people who are even feeling like nothing will work for me. It's not true. They can work.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking on The Morning Show with Ginny Sassaman. And if that last name sounds familiar, it may be because Ginny's daughter, Jennifer Sassaman, is a member of the theater faculty at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside and has been on The Morning Show any number of times to talk about the productions that she has directed at Parkside. Ginny Sassaman is here all the way from Vermont, in town not only to visit Jennifer and her family, but also to present a workshop this Saturday morning from 9 until 11 at Olympia Brown Church in downtown Racine, a workshop called Self-Care Tools for Stressful Times. And we'll be talking about that in just a couple of minutes. Ginny Sassaman is co-founder and president of the organization Gross National Happiness USA. and also creator of something called the Happiness Paradigm. And it's a really remarkable, beautiful website where you can access all kinds of things, including her blog and lots of resources there about this notion of happiness. Jenny Sassaman, we've already kind of touched on the fact that it is really easy to leap to certain conclusions that are really not correct about, in a sense, the seriousness of all this. I wonder, as you first began exploring this and talking about it and so on, did you do it with any trepidation about being, in a sense, misunderstood about, you know, what about how important this work was and how significant it's supposed to be? Because at a glance, it might seem, as you said earlier, something very, very fluffy and inconsequential and self-involved and, you know, all of it.
No, I had no trepidation. Maybe I should have. But no, because I, as I said, I was immediately taken with this concept of GNH, Gross National Happiness, when I read about Bhutan. And maybe that's because my background, you know, I've also been fairly political my whole life. Starting when I was in about second grade, I remember in my classroom, which was in central Pennsylvania. So this is giving away my age, but I am totally fine with that. I could care less. So we were having a mock election in the Kennedy-Nixon race. And I think there were about 25 kids in that classroom, and 23 voted for Nixon, and two of us voted for Kennedy. So I... But that's never deterred me. I've been kind of an activist for what I believe is right, and how things that I would like to see change in the world to make life better for other people. That's my whole life story. And before I had read about GNH, which was I first read that in 2009 when I read Eric Weiner's book, I had been really watching the growing income inequality in this country and feeling more and more upset about it and concerned and distressed, and, you know, watching, you know, corporate salaries get huge and the workers not keeping pace, that sort of thing. And looking for, well, what can be the answer? Because I wasn't seeing any answers. So when I stumbled across GNH, to me, that provides the answer. And I also want to hasten, in case there's anybody out there listening saying, okay, so flaming liberal, leftist, you know, I am, but the idea is not. And our organization is not. This is a nonpartisan view, and I believe a very unifying view. One of the projects of GNH USA is we have a happiness walk, walking in a big circle all around the country. So far, the walk has gone from Stowe, Vermont, down the east coast of the United States to Jacksonville, turning west, and has gotten as far as the Pacific Ocean. So 4,500 miles so far. And all along the way, we ask everybody we meet who come from all political backgrounds, all socioeconomic backgrounds, races, genders, ages, everybody, what matters most to them in life. And what we find is it's pretty much the same. It doesn't matter whether you were a person who supported Bernie or Hillary or Trump, or if you are a born-again Christian, or if you're Muslim or Jew or nothing, or if you're 10 or if you're 95. People basically all have the same ideas of what brings the happiness to their own lives, to the lives of their loved ones, to their communities, and it's not money. It's not money. So we see this GNH vision as actually having the potential to bring us together as a country.
Wow. Because, of course, there are some drastically different ideas about how we secure these things that all of us have in common as wanting. But it's very easy to focus solely on that and to not see that which binds all of us together. I really understand, too, what you were saying just now about how it really isn't money that makes us happy. Not long ago on Facebook, I saw a meme that I don't even remember now what the photograph was, but the caption of it essentially said, when you're dead and gone, nobody's going to be talking about the beautiful designer high heel shoes you wore or the beautiful designer couch that was in your living room. No one's going to care about that then. You shouldn't care about that now.
Right.
I mean, it was kind of a reminder that it is very easy to get caught up in the surface stuff that in the immediate moment might seem to bring us gratification and happiness.
Right.
But that isn't the way to really create a fully happy life in the deepest sense of the word.
No. And we do need money. For all kinds of reasons. You know, we need money for our health insurance. We need money for our children's education. So it's not like money is the bad guy. Money's just part of the picture. So that's what we're really all about, is including money in a bigger, broader definition of both personal well-being and, you know, community well-being and happiness.
I noticed on your website for the Gross National Happiness USA that there are also you like to sponsor or encourage people to do happiness dinners.
Oh, yes.
What are
yes.
happiness dinners?
Yes. So going back to what the fact that this is a very serious topic, the happiness dinners came out as an idea around International Day of Happiness. And International Day of Happiness actually was declared by the United Nations in 2012, because the United Nations also sees this as a pathway to worldwide well-being. If we focus on well-being for all instead of just focusing on money for a few. Mm. So it's a serious day, but it's also celebratory. So we came up with some guidelines for questions that people can ask at these dinners. And then we're asking them to give us feedback, because we're collecting data all along the way on to share. I mean, that's a whole nother topic, but it is kind of data driven. So what we do is provide a framework for happiness conversations and over food, which everybody likes food, I think. And I've hosted a couple of these dinners myself and been a guest at others. And they're so wonderful. You know, even with friends you know well, it just takes the conversation to a deeper level, but also a happy level, you know, a joyful level. And listening to people who you know describe, well, you know, what really makes me happy is going out in the woods and spending time in nature, or doing good for other people, or a very popular one around among my set of friends is being a grandparent, but really discussing it. And people's whole demeanors change when they relax into what really makes them happy. It's very heartfelt. So it's a wonderful way to spend an evening or an afternoon with people who are your friends, or actually you could do it with strangers, but to have this heartfelt conversation about what's most meaningful in life. So we set it up around the International Day of Happiness, but it could happen anytime. The guidelines are there. People can write to us anytime.
Very good. So all of that can be found at the website for Gross National Happiness. And I've mentioned a couple times that you also created something called the Happiness Paradigm, which is a really beautiful website that has all kinds of resources and poems and quotes and so on. I think my favorite quote of the many that were listed there was a quote by Robert Louis Stevenson who's one of my favorite poets, but I've never read this particular quote. Let's see where my glasses go so I can really read this. There is no duty we so underrate as the duty of being happy. Mm-hmm. By being happy, we sow anonymous benefits upon the world. That is such an interesting way to think about it, because I think, if anything, we tend to think of somebody who wants to be happy. I mean, if that's like the sole focus of their life, it's easy to kind of think of that as an exercise in self-absorption, that nothing matters more than me being happy, even if it means you're not as happy or whatever, or being just unaware of the happiness of others. And the way Robert Louis Stevenson frames it, and much the way you've framed it today, it's that, in a sense, you are a better citizen of the world, a better member of the human race, when you begin from a place of happiness and gratitude. It allows you to be open to those around you.
I feel that way very much. The Dalai Lama has said, if you want to be happy, practice compassion. And if you want others to be happy, practice compassion. To a great extent, creating greater happiness in ourselves also builds our compassion muscles. And so we're much better able, I think, to see our interconnectedness with other people and to understand that we're all just humans trying to do the best we can here. You know, it's also my personal lived experience. And of course, I'm no saint, so I'm not always floating on my little happiness cloud. But last week I had an experience. So I was in Miami for this World Happiness Summit. And towards the end of it, so it was an amazing event filled with happiness and really filling up my personal happiness bucket. I was just overflowing, you know, life was good. And I got on the bus to come into the venue from where I was staying, and I sat down next to a woman who was really grumpy. She was miserable, and she was not happy with me because I had a cup of coffee with me, which apparently was not allowed. She pointed that out. So she started chastising me immediately, like, you're not allowed to have that, and you better not spill that on me because I have to go to work. And it was unpleasant. And had I also been in a grumpy mood, a less happy place, I could have said right back to her, right, which would have left her unhappy, me unhappy, and all the people around us on the bus would have also been uneasy and feeling the negative vibes. It would have been ugly for everybody. But instead, I was in a great place, so I was able to respond to her concerns and start chatting with her. And by the end of the bus ride, she was happy, I was happy. You know, she... she wished me a nice day. And so it was a happier, more pleasant event for everybody there, including myself and her. So that's just a little tiny story. But in truth, that's what our lives are made up of.
Right.
One little tiny event after another little tiny event. And moment to moment, we have the option of making somebody else happier or making them less happy in almost every interaction. And I think when we're coming from a place of greater peace, greater contentment, greater joy, greater compassion, we're much better able to help somebody else maybe feel a little bit better.
In the last couple of minutes that remain to us, I want to give you a chance to tell people a little more about the workshop that you're going to be doing Saturday morning beginning at 9 o'clock at Olympia Brown Church in downtown Racine. Again, the title of it is Self-Care Tools for Stressful Times. I don't think we have to explain what stressful times are or why these times are stressful for just about everybody. And I should hasten to add, too, I think just about everybody I know, whatever side of the political aisle they happen to be on, or if they're not even politically inclined at all, is feeling a really heightened sense of stress right now. I mean, I don't know anybody in my life actually who isn't feeling that. So I certainly find this notion very intriguing about self-care tools that might be helpful at this moment in time. What kinds of things are you going to be talking about and or doing on Saturday?
And it will be both talking and doing. We'll be practicing actual tools. And I don't want to give too many of them away. There are certainly there's breathing methods that anybody can use to calm down, but we'll practice very specific ways that you can look for the silver lining, which is helpful. Just a wide variety of tools. Some of them will be physical. Some of them will be writing things down. Some of them will be contemplating what each of us is like when we're at our very best. One of them I'll share, this is a TED Talk people can watch if they want to. There's a woman named Amy Cuddy, C-U-D-D-Y, and she has done research on power poses. So merely the way that we sit or stand can make us feel better. So we'll do some power poses. So we'll do some moving, and I can pretty much guarantee there'll be a fair amount of laughter. There may also be some tears, and it will be a whole bunch of different tools. So each person can go away with one or two or three that they want to try on their own, because we have to take care of ourselves, be happier, in order to help make the world better. And plus, it doesn't make anything better for us to be unhappy.
Right. So it's a little bit like that oxygen mask coming
totally
down.
Totally the oxygen mask.
You put on your own before you,
see
to those around you.
That's exactly right.
So the workshop, again, is this Saturday morning, 9 to 11. I can give the phone number for Olympia Brown Unitarian Church.
Or you could give my email. I've been asking people to email me.
Okay.
If they are planning to come. So that's Happiness Paradigm. And Paradigm, I know, is some people get hung up on the spelling, but it's Paradigm. So Happiness Paradigm at Gmail.
Very good. And otherwise, the phone number at Olympia Brown is 634-0659, 634-0659. Ginny Sassaman, president and co-founder of Gross National Happiness USA, also creator of the website Happiness Paradigm, and a frequent contributor, I know, to the Huffington Post.
Yeah, yeah.
Ginny Sassaman, it's been great to meet you today. Thank you so much for taking a little bit of time away from your family visit to join me today on the morning show. And I hope a lot of people will be seeking out this opportunity to meet you on Saturday and to work with you on some self-care tools in these stressful times in which we're all living. Thank you so much for being part of the morning show today.
Thank you so much.
Tomorrow on the morning show, I look forward to a visit from Dr. Thomas Carr from the paleontology department at Carthage College, talking about the most recent research that he has done into dinosaurs. And on Friday, we will be talking politics with Dr. Jerry Mast from Carthage's political science department. The morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. The program is archived on our website, WGTD.org. Support for WGTD's morning show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenosians who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served